We had our week away, but we had an episode. So, you know, the July 4th week, I was out of town. We recorded on the day after the previous episode, and that was when the Jonny Ive news broke. And so we had our live reaction to that. There have been some news stories in that space since then, but we're not going to talk about them too much today, since there's been so much other news since last week to talk about. The first thing I want to say is thanks to everyone who listened to the second part of last week's Happy Hour episode, where we included the first part of my new Watch Time podcast for 9 to 5 Mac. Benjamin, you were the guest, and I again, thank you for that.
No problem.
And for everyone who's checked out the full episode and subscribed, I really appreciate it. When this is a new project like that, you have no idea how it's going to be received, if it's going to be like a percentage of what we do together. And, you know, it just, you don't know what to expect. So it's always fun to see, you know, how the numbers actually turn out and how the feedback turns out. And so far I've been really happy with that and look forward to doing more episodes in season one. Mayo, let's talk about what's happened with Jonny Ive since our live reactions of last week's episode.
Yeah, I guess the big stuff is like the Bloomberg timeline and the Wall Street Journal story, where that, you know, the quote unquote big respected publications came out with their pretty lengthy discussions about Jonny Ive's tenure and how he began to slip away. And obviously then there's a big, you know, backlash against that. In the, both the Wall Street Journal and the Bloomberg stories kind of, you know, agree with each other for the most part. Like the Journal story had some weird, like, random factoids like plugged in there, like the watch has been an epic failure and all this, but so, you know, ignore but if you strip out all these like stupid stats and, you know, the narratives that are clearly like enforced by the editorial team, and not just like, if you stick to like the source information, to me at least it sounds like reasonably accurate. There's been obviously a lot of contention, and it depends which side of the fence that you sit on, but the main like point of those things is that Jonny was, you know, personally invested in bringing the Apple Watch to market. He campaigned to the executive team as one of the like proponents of doing a watch in the first place back in like the 2012-2013 time frame. There was pushback from other people about, you know, whether it would actually be a compelling product, but ultimately Tim Cook supported Ive's you know, arguments and gave him the sign off to actually go and make the watch. And then there was clearly like collaboration between all the different teams and, you know, to actually bring the product to market. But after the Apple Watch shipped in 2015, it's generally reported now that Ive began to, you know, drift apart from the company. He became less day-to-day, less in the nitty-gritty and the weeds of, you know, this is what we're making a product. Like with the watch, clearly he had from, you know, the very early days, the sketches about roughly what he thought the watch was going to look like. Mm-hmm. If you go back to that the video from a few years ago that you even saw in his notebook, where he had like a picture of the watch outline with the honeycomb grid circles, like, you know, sketched out, like that was his, you know, his vision, and he drove it through.
Yeah.
And even in the Ian Parker story that came out, was it called A Time of Change of Things to Come? Something like that. A Story of Things to Come. I'm messing up the name. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In that, he even talked about being like deeply tied and whatnot. And that's basically what Bloomberg and Wall Street Journal report. They talk about how he was supposedly meant to be in charge of signing off on some like iPhone 10 design software stuff, but then he wouldn't show up to meetings, or he was late and wouldn't be drawn on making a decision. That caused some internal frustration, and it held up production, and it held up, you know, making actually decisions, which is, you know, kind of problematic when you're like the people everyone's looking up to inside the company to give your final word in this stuff. And how they, Jonny set up like a separate design office closer to his home, and so he didn't have to commute into, you know, Apple Park every single day to sort that stuff out. And that's basically the gist of the situation. And then those stories come out. You know, I think they're generally reasonable. It kind of makes sense with what's going on. Obviously, there's the bit where apparently Tim Cook convinced Jonny to take back day-to-day responsibilities. That was when they removed Howorth and Dai from the executive page in like 2017. But then apparently Ive's behavior or his, you know, commitment to the company didn't really change, and he, you know, again went back to kind of normal. And that's led up today where he, you know, he's officially leaving.
Yeah.
The controversy really sprung up when Tim Cook emailed NBC News, who I think had asked him for a comment on the story. So Apple didn't like issue a formal response to the Wall Street Journal, we just have this, you know, by proxy through the email to NBC, where basically Tim Cook says, you know, this is all absurd and a mischaracterization of the company and a fundamental misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The couple of things. So like you said, in the Wall Street Journal report, there were some like weird stats that were just thrown in there to kind of spice up the story, but they weren't like, you know, they didn't tell us much about Johnny Ive. I think the biggest one, like you said, was the watch stat, which was that, you know, A, there were lots of unsold gold watches, which they said there'd be limited quantity of. Apparently, they even limited quantities. They didn't sell many, which is not a hidden secret. And then, because they didn't continue selling them the next year. And then that they had one goal for the watch in the first year, but it was severely below that for all watch types. But even, like, that's just like, I don't think like Johnny Ive's job was to forecast how many watches they would sell. It was to design it. And he did that. And that the forecasting part was like Tim Cook and maybe Jeff Williams. And even so, like beyond the first year, they made great improvements. And it seems like the watch is a success now. Like it's not a big part of the company. They talk about wearables and it's in that category, but, you know, it's not like iPhone or services, but, I think that single year stat of how it's doing versus in that year versus expectations wasn't very helpful. And they also kind of like seemed to pin, you know, Air Power was Johnny's vision and it was just, you know, it was more like it was just a nightmare scenario. And all those things are just like, so like, look at the last few years and not like the whole of his career and contribution to Apple. And, you know, that's because they're trying to tell the story of how we got to where we are today, where he's leaving the company. But you can kind of see why Tim Cook doesn't like the way that's portrayed, because it isn't the whole story of Johnny Ive at Apple. And the contribution he made, you know, working alongside Steve Jobs before Steve Jobs was even at Apple, he was designing things there. You know, so that's something.
Yeah. And the Cook email doesn't like specifically point out, you know, like facts that are incorrect. It just kind of says the article mischaracterizes what was going on.
To the point where we don't recognize the company it talks about, right?
Yeah. And so it's like, most of those events, you know, that are described in the story probably could be true even, and then mm-hmm. the Cook email still not be a lie. Like the thing about you know, Johnny not turning up and then the team basically being lost for words about what to do. Maybe realistically Johnny didn't turn up that day because, you know, his father was ill, because that's one of the other things, you know, like obviously his parents are getting older and older and he kept mm-hmm. flying back to London to, you know, for like perfectly reasonably, you know, go and like care for them. So maybe Johnny didn't turn up, but then the team made a decision anyway and got on with it. Whereas, you know, the journal story painted it as more people just like left at a crossroads because they didn't know what to do, which I'm sure is not the case. Like there would have been, you know, lower management, whether that's Dai, Howarth, you know, whoever else, to step in and, you know, make this stuff roll. Because ultimately, iPhone 10 did come out in that September, and it was really good. And I think, you know, especially, and this is particularly talking about the software, right? He was, you know, supposed mm-hmm. to be signing off on the unlock gestures. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. The iPhone 10 came out really well, and the gesture system was fantastic and widely praised, you know, not just us, like,
to the point where Android has to copy it from their initial bad launch of gestures. And then they say, well, I think they're still changing what's going on, but was it version Q? And they just take it. They said, what we had last year, everyone hated it, so let's just do what the iPhone's doing.
And so the iPhone 10 came out, and then the next summer in Android P, they basically were like, we need to do gestures, but we don't want to copy the iPhone. So they went and tried something different, but it was clearly inferior to what the iPhone did. And so now this year's Android release essentially copies the iPhone's gestures straight
and
out.
No one's mad about it. Like Android.
Yeah, and everyone's like, well, yes, because the iPhone gestures work incredibly well and it feels incredibly smooth. And it's still one of the things that makes like my iPhone 10 feel really, really modern. You know, you can mm-hmm. just flick through all those things and move around and it's great. So like, you know, picking on the iPhone 10 gestures, maybe there were some hiccups along the way, but you know, you can't argue with the end result there.
Yeah, the one insight I did see from the story, the reporting from Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal was that you could just see this happening, was that whenever Richard Howarth and Alan Dai were in charge, and Johnny was more on the Apple Park project and less, you know, day-to-day stuff, that designers on the team still saw what they got approved from Alan Dai and Richard Howarth of, you know, we've got their approval, but we need final write-off from Johnny Ive for this. Like,
yeah, they kind of saw Howorth and Dyer's like rubber stamping it, whereas they really wanted, you know, Ives. They craved Ives' approval and his recognition, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's well respected. And this is kind of the core of what I take away from the Bluebird WSJ stories, where the only real like problem that happened here was the thing in the end of 2017 where Johnny Ive, you know, was marketed as supposedly returning to day-to-day responsibilities and management. Apparently, that means like Cook sat down with him, convinced him to come back. Mm-hmm. And we saw, because obviously in 2015, he became chief design officer, and Howorth and Dye took positions as VPs on the leadership page, and then they fell away. And then in 2017, they got removed, and Johnny Ive got put back as, you know, just the head of everything, supposedly. Yeah. But then internally, that seemingly didn't happen. And it was kind of, to me, it feels like they were trying to cling on to, you know, the aura of Johnny Ive. Like, Kip was like, we can't lose this guy, we can't lose this guy, we can't lose this guy. But then that just causes problems where people expect him to still be in there, and when he isn't, you're just causing friction, you're causing, mm-hmm. you know, it's better at some point to just, like, cut it off at the womb, you know, cut off, like, cauterize it and move on. And
yeah.
that seems to be where we are now at, right, in mm-hmm. in the newest, latest round of, you know, organizational changes.
Yeah, and I struggled to kind of like this story felt like a huge story in the history of Apple, and at 9to5 Mac our job is to write, you know, every day about what's going on with Apple, and I felt off about this because it was a huge story and there was Bloomberg reporting on like background and Wall Street Journal reporting on background and that drama, but just like zooming way out, I struggled with, you know, what my contribution to the story for 9to5 Mac was going to be beyond just this is what the news is and we'll discuss it on this podcast. And ultimately I came around to, you know, I wrote a thing about Apple Watch and the legacy of Johnny Ive making health mainstream through design, and just kind of collecting how much evidence there is about how invested Johnny Ive was in the Apple Watch, and then just take the watch, you know, for what it is as a pretty object, and then look at what it's doing through health. And he's even commented publicly in interviews, which I've included in the piece, about how from the start he even saw health as, you know, a big impact it can have. But the big premise for me is if the watch was ugly, no one would wear it. And then even if it did X, Y, and Z that were phenomenal, it doesn't matter because it's ugly and no one's going to wear it. And we've seen Android try and do useful watches, and to some degree there's some interest, but not like huge success, and no one's doing like, oh, version one was a success, so let's do version 2, 3, and 4 now, like where you've seen that with the watch. And it's because Johnny saw the formula of look at existing watches that people wear and have loved for hundreds of years, and let's take that formula and evolve it for what an Apple Watch will be without being like super high tech and gadgety. And, you know, like if you look at the watch, the Apple Watch, it doesn't look like an analog watch really, but it looks more like a watch than it looks like a heart rate monitor that you can buy today, like a, you know, some medical technology, a fall detector, an emergency call alert, you know, that like if you, all those have existed before. An ECG, like all these things exist as like medical grade technology, but not like something that somebody would wear and then never use that stuff. They just like the way it looks as like a fashion object.
Yeah, and clearly one of Ive's like masterstrokes was partnering with Mark Newson to help, mm-hmm. you know, sort out the bands situation. And
yeah.
the sport band's going to go down as like one of the most best things Apple ever made in terms of accessories. And that is clearly influenced from, you know, from the Newson designs.
Yeah, and he goes, like he had a role in Apple once the watch was a project, even though he was like a longtime personal friend of Johnny. It was the Apple role that formalized him within Apple. And then he goes to what, From Love with Johnny and this new firm. But
Love From, yeah.
Yeah, Love From. So even, you know, like you mentioned, the sport band, like that was a newsome thing when you look at the what is it called? The pod.
iPod. Yeah.
iPod. Yeah. It's like, it's
not
that,
the iPod, the iPod.
The iPod, yeah, IKEPOD. It's that band, but for the Apple Watch, which is clever because it isn't like a loop where you tuck the excess, you know, band under another little loop that holds on, but it goes within itself. And that's clever. The link bracelet was also quite clever, and that still exists. It's just kind of being backdoored now, but that you can take apart each link or add more without using a tool. Like that was pretty, like maybe that existed in some places, but it wasn't very common. And then the Apple Watch is like, look, we're doing this smarter, you know, and you can easily adjust it.
Yeah. And you know, the whole line in the PR where it's like, you know, LoveFrom will be a, Apple will be a primary client of LoveFrom, and they will continue to work on Apple designs. Like, the stuff like watch bands is exactly what I imagine when they're talking about that relationship.
Because
when you leave the company and you're not there day to day, clearly you're not going to be working on, you know, hardware. Maybe some of the stuff that's currently in development now and has to get out the door that clearly I've been, you know, working on for a while, maybe that he'll still have that relationship. But in general, like, if you're thinking like longer term, and you believe that they are still going to have some sort of connection, in the same way that like Ammunition helped with like Beats, you know, hardware design for a while, you know, that you're not working on like core product, you're just working on the next version of these headphones, right? I think watch bands like a perfect area where it'd be like, yeah, we can, you know, ask Johnny and Mark Newson at LoveFrom to go and make some cool watch bands, and then they'll just be ours for the watch, and that'll be it. Like, that's like a perfect area where it's very self-contained. Johnny can still, you know, meet up with his friends inside Apple when he wants to and have fun just doing, you know, something very simple and elegant, and not have to worry about the massive like manufacturing chain and operations divisions and all the gumph that comes across, you know, like making a brand new phone or AR glasses and that stuff. But like, you know, Johnny can make some cool watch bands and still be part of Apple, and you know, that kind of disconnected way, that's like the perfect area.
And I could see it being like, you know, they say Apple's a client of Johnny Ive's firm. But there's never a time where Tim Cook says to Johnny's firm, make us this, this is your task. It's that Johnny comes up with something clever out of just pure interest in design and offers it first to Apple. Has like, you know, I've got this clever way to do a new band, and I think it'd be perfect for the Apple Watch. Do you want this from me? And, you know, otherwise it'll get used somewhere else. And that could be how it works. And not just bands, but like maybe some clever way to do an iPhone case, or just anything that he thinks solves a problem through design could be really cool.
Yeah. I don't think they're lying in the consultancy connection is just, you know, PR fluff, and yeah, Johnny's never going to work for Apple ever again.
It's
just going to be
than,
on a much smaller scale, right? Yeah.
Yeah. It's different than when Forstall was like fired, and but he remained a consultant, you know, to Apple
for
a period. And that was more like just like a quiet period. Like, maybe we'll need you if we like have some questions that only you could answer.
Yeah. We need you to tell us the password to the servers. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're never going to ask you for advice on how to run the company.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Johnny thing, it's to me, it just kind of is what it is. And it's part of watching Apple continue. And it's way better of a story than like, you know, Johnny died because he's like of old age, you know, that kind of thing. Like, he worked at Apple until the day he died. It's like, it's a little bit more romantic than that. It's not a nightmare. I think everyone's kind of cooled off and realized, like, you know, for the most part, there has been a limited role from Johnny over the past few years. And if you're a fan of what you've seen so far, then everything's going to be okay.
And obviously Apple's like promoting Jeff Williams now as like the product lead. They're trying to market him more than just, you know, operations per se.
Yeah. Like, I think that was probably the best observation from the Wall Street, like a separate Wall Street Journal piece, I think. It came after the one that Apple didn't like. But it was basically a story to say, look, Apple changed the leadership page about Jeff Williams to kind of not like rewrite history, but like change how they're telling his story. And
The biography on Apple's website was recently changed to read, Jeff led the development of Apple Watch in close collaboration with the design team, an overseas engineering team is responsible for Apple Watch. And then it says, until late last month, that section simply read, he oversees development of Apple Watch. So they kind of like expounded you know, at least to the public, expanded his role. And there was even a funny thing in that story where they were like, oh yeah, Jeff Williams was used for the iPhone 4. This is some, you know, some fun flurry. Like this whole news article was almost like a, you know, like an intentional leak of, let's just make Jeff Williams sound more important, right? And maybe internally he has been really critical. It's just they haven't done a good job to date, really, of showing that, right?
Yeah, like, he's had plenty of stage time, especially since the Series 2 watch. And I think maybe the first time I recall seeing him on stage was like Research Kit. And he talked about Research Kit whenever the watch was, it had been announced, but I don't think he had a big part of the first like Apple Watch teaser event. But yeah. I think then he did Research Kit on stage, and that was the same event where the watch got a release date and the 12-inch MacBook was introduced for the first time, et cetera, like in March 2015. From watching that this week, just out of interest, Tim Cook at the end of his presentation of Apple Watch, like part two on a keynote stage, At the very end, he said something like, everyone who's worked on this at Apple here and around the world, stand up. And then he's like, that means you, Johnny. That means you, Jeff. And that makes me think like, oh, they really aren't rewriting history. They're just reframing how they're telling the story. They're using more details to emphasize Jeff. But like at that keynote, he called out Jeff Williams before he was like a keynote figure in a big way.
Yeah, for sure. This episode of Happy Hour is brought to you by Hyper and their new Hypercube. It's a brand new product that automatically backs up your iPhone, iPad, or Android device while also serving double duty as a charger. It's a cool 2-in-1 accessory. So the way the Hypercube works is this tiny little device that connects between your USB charger and your iPhone or Android phone. It then automatically backs up all of your photos, videos, contacts, and more onto either a microSD card or a USB drive. You just plug your standard power cable into one end, and your iPhone or iPad plugs in with a standard Lightning to USB cable. Then insert either a USB stick or a microSD card, and you're good to go. Now, whenever you're charging your device with the Hypercube, all of your photos and videos will be automatically backed up. The best part is you don't have to sign up to any cloud services. There's no recurring subscription fees of any kind. Moreover, the Hypercube also acts as a USB drive itself, so you can insert it into your computer to get instant access to your files, use it with your iPad Pro, or browse your media on any iOS device using the free Hyper Companion app. Plug in, charge, backup, go. So here's our special offer. For a limited time, you can pre-order the Hypercube for only $29, which is an incredible deal. Go to hypershop.com/95Mac to learn more and to take advantage of that special offer, which lets you pre-order the new Hypercube. Hypercube, the device that backs up your iPhone or Android device's photos and videos whilst you're charging. Again, that's hypershop.com/95Mac. Go there and check it out. Thanks so much to Hyper for sponsoring Happy Hour.
All right, Mayo, moving on from the past to the present. I mentioned several weeks ago that I bought this Samsung Smart TV that was supposed to be like the cheapest model to work with AirPlay 2 and the Apple TV app, because Samsung's the first to bring those to market without needing an Apple TV. And then LG, Sony, Vizio doing it later this year. I bought the TV like back in May when that was announced as like released firmware. And then there was this huge wait for the firmware, and then it was released, and I had to put it on a flash drive to get it to install. What I didn't mention is that I did get it installed, and then there was just nothing there to see. So it was like no update. It was just very disappointing. coming back home from like 6 days away from home for the vacation I had, I came back and just out of nowhere, the same firmware, the TV app was there and AirPlay 2 worked. I was amazed.
And the stars aligned.
Yeah, it was such an into an era. It was like, oh, there we go. So the TV app works great, looks great. The TV, I mean, it's $300 for like a 43-inch 4K TV. I think it's a little bit slow, like way slower than the Apple TV 4K box, of course. And so everything like has to like, the app has to like launch and load. And then once you're in the app, it's pretty good, but it's just like the launch time for the app is a little bit slow. And then AirPlay 2, like it works really well. And there's like design that I haven't seen before. I'm going to do a story on it this week, probably. Especially since it's like $300, and then an Apple TV can be like for $200. It's crazy. But if it's what you need, it's really well. It works really well. The funny thing is like, I had given up on my TV getting the firmware update. So I was talking with Samsung PR about sending out a loaner TV, and that back and forth was taking a long time. And then they sent me a Word X document to fill out to like agree to the loaner so I can like test and write about, they were going to send me like a 55-inch, they call it QLED, but I guess like an OLED TV. And then I would need to send it back, just for, you know, after the story was over with. And I put off signing the form because I got it the day I was leaving town, and I was like, I'll get to that later. And on Monday, they emailed me to say, like, follow up, you know, by the way, get that back to us and we'll ship it out to you as soon as possible. And then it was like Tuesday when the TV updated. So it was perfect timing in all regards. So that saga's over. It's a 43-inch Samsung, UN6300 or something. When you go to do AirPlay, it says like Samsung 6 Series TV, I think.
And the Samsung TVs, not just the cheap ones, all of them, they get the TV app and AirPlay 2, but they don't integrate with HomeKit.
Yeah, which is, and at the beginning, the ones that will do HomeKit won't have the TV app, but then eventually they might. Is that right?
Yeah, that's kind of how they pitched it.
Yeah, the messaging on this has been so weird. But yeah, so I would say this as a, like, just a recommendation. If you have the Samsung TV already, then you get something cool for free. But I probably wouldn't go out and spend a lot of money on a nice version of this. Like, $300 is one thing. It's a lot of money, but it's not nothing. Or it's not like $2,000. But if you're going to buy like an investment TV that you want to have as like your reference television in your living room for like watching movies and everything for the next several years, then I would probably wait until the fall when you can see what is available with HomeKit and AirPlay 2, and then hopefully the TV app, because that's more impressive. You know, I've been doing the HomeKit stuff through HomeBridge, where you can run unauthorized HomeKit accessories, and that's really cool. And I still can't do everything that you could do with a HomeKit TV, but just being able to turn it on and off with Siri is really neat, and use automation. But I would, you know, I'll mention this in my story when I write it, but I would definitely wait and just watch the market and see what's coming with HomeKit, because that's a big thing to miss out on.
Yeah, because without HomeKit, you can't talk to Siri and tell it to play something on the television. It just won't recognize the accessory. So,
right, it looks for a TV
that's attached to your home, but even though it's showing up as an AirPlay 2 output, it doesn't know it's in the home database, so it doesn't find
it. So you don't get that voice control where you say play the Grinch on the living room TV. That does work if you've got an Apple TV or a HomeKit TV, but this wouldn't be that.
Yeah, and if you're thinking, you know, a bit longer term and you are subscribed to like Apple TV Plus and stuff, you can imagine just going like, oh, play the morning show in the living room, and then it comes September and you could buy a Vizio LG TV instead that can do that. You're going to feel a bit bummed when you're seeing it with a Samsung TV that was a few months earlier, but, you know, isn't getting that functionality.
Yeah. By the way, like, I don't have this in the notes to discuss, but I'm getting really curious about some form of the Fire TV, I guess, is the box, not like the dongle. But something that you can say to an Echo, I think. I think this is possible, but say to an Echo, not just the remote for the device, but like your Echo that you can just speak out in the air to. Just say, play WLOX on Hulu. And I think that's it. I know you can do that with an Echo show with Hulu Live TV. It's like name a station and play it. I think maybe with a Fire TV you could do that too. I'm not sure. I have to look into that. But
yeah, I think you can.
Yeah, tell your Echo to launch the Hulu app, and then that would turn the TV on with HDMI CEC, and then your TV comes on, and you've got like local news playing at 6:30 or something. Like, that's what I want. And as good as the Apple TV is at so many things, like presenting, you know, 4K HDR iTunes movie purchases, and then having, you know, Apple Music and the podcast app locally, whenever the TV app comes to more places, like it's coming to the Fire TV boxes this fall, I believe they've already announced, that'll be pretty compelling, because then you, like, if you also get like 4K YouTube, which you can't do on the Apple TV because of the disagreement over the file format, I could be torn. I could be like pulled away from using the Apple TV, but just because the experience isn't the best experience anymore, even if it's premium experience, you know, that costs more. If you can do less with it, it's just not that great.
Yeah, turning on the TV and playing and making the TV light up by itself and, you know, via voice would be fine on the Apple TV for stuff in, like, the TV app, in the TV library, like TV Plus or whatever, but yeah, it's not going to work with, you know, just like a random third-party app.
Yeah, and I really like the ability to just turn the TV on and have, like, live local news playing, like you would do in the old days with cable TV. And it's just so many clicks and swipes and, you know, commands required to get to just that on like smart TV boxes, you know.
Yeah, they are expanding with like what you can automate in Shortcuts with the Apple TV. Like, you can control like the Apple TV remote through Shortcuts now and stuff. So they're definitely like edging in that direction, but they are behind on those areas.
Yeah, Apple TV is a product I'm not passionate about, and like if don't care where it goes, just because there's other solutions that are like getting better for less money and less friction. So
yeah, I like it, but I do think it's overpriced for what you get at the moment.
Yeah,
it's just too expensive,
especially as Apple opens up with what you can do without it.
Yeah, I mean, you said you can get a 4K Apple TV for $200. You can get a whole TV for $300.
You get an actual 4K TV for $300 with AirPlay 2 and the TV app.
Yeah, like the equation definitely doesn't like add up somewhere.
Yeah. And you don't get like the podcast app or the Apple Music app, but you get AirPlay, which can do those things from your iPhone. All right, let's also talk about we joked last week that we missed all the news about the new betas and all the changes that were, especially in like macOS Catalina with all the redesigned Catalyst apps that were originally on Mojave. For a time, it seemed like we were not going to get betas last week. Like, we didn't get the usual heads up that we often get, and we didn't get the usual, release schedule.
It was just it was random.
Yeah, it was kind of random. But they did come, and so we did miss out on those last week, but here we are this week to discuss those. Let's go through some changes that were there. And I'll also concede to you that there were no changes visible at all to the original, Marzipan apps.
Yeah, that's how they're shipping, guys.
Yeah,
I don't want to rest now.
Yeah, I think you're right.
However, macOS does get a cool little feature in this update, which is completely out of left field. For like the first time in a decade, there's a new screensaver.
It's like just really good.
Yeah, it's called Drift, and it kind of looks like, you know, like strobing light patterns, kind of like a sea urchin thing. Where like I think of it the house that Nemo lives in Finding Nemo, you know, where it like sways back and forth, but it's more abstract now. It's like light patterns going around. It's called Drift, and it's like the first screensaver or change of the screensavers in like a decade, but it's a really cool effort.
It reminds me of some of the visuals that you see either from like not wallpapers, but like videos playing on Macs during the demos, or the really vibrant, like color swirling wallpapers that have been included lately, but not as a screensaver, just as a still image. But this is a wallpaper, and it's got some features to it too. It's not just like one thing. It can change colors, right?
Yeah, there's like a little options menu, and you can pick from like blues or space gray or spectrum, which is like all colors of the rainbow. Or even there's an option which like mirrors the colors from your desktop wallpaper. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a lot of flexibility there. It's like, if you actually look at the screensaver's screen system preferences, you know, all of the like little icons for all the other screensavers, it's like they haven't even been updated into like the flat era. They're still kind of like skeuomorphic icons and everything. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just it's like walking to the past when you go on that picture screen. But now they've just out of the blue added this new screensaver that's really cool. So,
yep. Do you use screensavers?
You know, I think I actually have one, but I don't have it on a timer. I have it on a hot corner, and so sometimes when I'm bored, I'll do it, but it's rare.
Yeah, so hot corners are the option to put your cursor in one of the four corners of your display and have an action happen, like put your display to sleep, start or stop a screensaver, show your desktop, show notification center. I use all of those features, and they're not on by default. I think they're very useful, though. I did this to try the screensaver, which looks lovely, and I've been using it just to see it. But once I get over the novelty of, oh, a new screensaver on macOS for the first time since I started using a Mac, I don't know where it makes sense for me anymore. Or maybe like, I guess I don't know what happens on the status of my apps, maybe how the display going to sleep is different from a screensaver starting. And I just think of like the display going to sleep as like the modern screensaver, which is different from the computer going to sleep. Because when the display goes to sleep, like on an iMac, then I think things can still happen in the background that wouldn't happen if the computer was asleep.
Yeah. The screen just turns off, but the computer's still running. And then you can, in the power settings, you can say screen turn off after half an hour, or then computer sleep after 2 hours or whatever. Like,
exactly.
The independence.
Yeah. And so does display sleep do the same thing as screensaver on? Or are you getting more with screensaver on? Because to me, I just can't imagine using a screensaver for just lots of reasons. Like, yeah, it's saving your screen from having one still image on it, but it's also like your screen's on, and it's just more efficient to turn off the display altogether and then have...
Yeah, so when the screensaver's on, it's as if your computer is still on. It's just showing something over the top of it. Then when you go to display off, it's as if your computer's on, but the screen's not on. So you are, obviously it's more efficient because it's not having to power the screen.
Yeah.
And then computer sleep is where it actually starts, you know, pulling things back.
Yeah. But like, can an app like Slack change my status with display sleep versus screensaver on? Like, I don't think so, but I was just curious.
I think Slack would idle anyway, just for you not touching it.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, there's other changes too in these betas. So one of the kind of cool techie new things is this FaceTime eye correction feature, and it's only on newer devices. So tell me about this.
Yeah, so yeah, again, the iOS 13, it's so far we've got the white portrait lighting effect is not on the iPhone X, and now this FaceTime eye correction feature is not on the iPhone X. It's on XS, XS Max, XR. And it kind of uses like some augmented reality, like face detection stuff to change the, like morph the pixels around your eyes. Essentially, it's almost like a Snapchat filter, but rather than trying to be like, make yourself look pretty or beautiful or anything like that, it's only to basically change where the eyes are looking. And so it stretches or moves the eye area around to make it look like if you're looking at where the camera is, to make it look like you're actually... Sorry, if you're looking at the screen, it makes it look like you're looking directly at the camera. Because obviously this is a problem in video chat when you're on the phone, is that you have to look at the screen to see the other person, but then they can tell that you're not looking directly into the camera lens, you're looking a bit downwards. And so basically what this setting does is it tracks your eyes and like squeezes your eyes upwards to make it look like you're looking straight ahead.
Yeah.
Now, I think it's cool.
Yeah, it's also on the new iPad, so it's all the new whatever chip that uses, whereas I think that filter was not on the new iPads. I think it's cool, too. We tried to use this, and we didn't see, like, big changes, but then there have been some other demos that you can see it better. Do you have to have the same, like a supported device on both ends of the call, or can just one person do it that has the new phone, new iPad?
I don't know. I assume the video stream is sent from the other end, though, so it'd feel like you'd only need the sender to have the settings switched on.
Yeah.
Because it's not like live photos where, because obviously for a live photo, if me and you are on a call, I have to turn on live photos in settings for you to be able to take a live photo of me, right? Like, it's like a permission system, whereas this FaceTime eye correction, it's literally like you're applying a filter. Like, so rather than putting a Memoji over your face, you're sending the video with your eyes adjusted.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I saw some people were kind of creeped out by it, like the whole premise of changing reality in the way that you can't tell. But maybe that's an issue, like at a high level, but I think like the practical thing that it's doing is clever. And maybe we'll hear more about the specifics of how it works and you know what they're doing here, but or you know why certain devices can do it. I guess it's just pure power, but it seems neat.
Yeah, I feel like the controversy around it was a bit stupid. Like people kept bringing up this idea of like, oh, it's like a deep fake, you know, but like deep fakes are an issue where, you know, like machine learning and generation is like faking entire video conversations that people never had. But, you know, that's not what this is. It's just slightly moving where your eyes are looking. It's like, and, you know, even if you still look to the left and the right, obviously that's going to be reflected still. It's only doing a very minor adjustment. And I don't know, it seems like a bit of an overreaction to me for people to freak out about it. It just seems like a cool little thing they've done to make a FaceTime call slightly more personal.
Yeah. And then something less controversial, iPad keyboard focus indicator, what's happening here?
Yeah, so... Obviously, since iOS 9, you can put multiple windows on the iPad screen at once, two side by side. But there hasn't really been a way to see if you've got an external keyboard connected, which is like the active window. On a Mac, the active window is lit up. It's got a different drop shadow. The deactivated windows are kind of grayed out in the toolbar and the sidebar, and their shadows are a lot softer.
You have the status bar at the top to tell you which menu bar.
Exactly, yeah. It literally says the name of the key app, the key window. Mm-hmm. You know exactly which window is going to be. If you start typing, you know where that text is going. On the iPad, you know, really, we haven't really had anything for that per se. In iOS 13 Beta 3, they've given you a tiny little morsel in that the grab handle indicators, like, so on iOS 13 now, there's a draggable, you know, like home indicator style icon glyph thing on the title bars of both of the active apps in split view. And so now those are grayed out. And then if you've got a keyboard connected, the focused app, the little pill turns black. So you can kind of get a sense of which one has focus. And obviously,
it's very subtle, but it's there, right?
Yeah, it's so. Obviously, when you're on a 12-inch iPad, you probably don't need the same visual decoration as like a Mac, where you could have like 10 windows spread across like a 30-inch screen, you know, like that size. When you're on a 12-inch screen, you know, you can get away with subtler indicators. They probably could go slightly further down the road just to make it more obvious to people, but I think it's fine. Like, it's, and at least it's better than nothing. And there's not like an obvious alternative thing mm-hmm. you can do, because you don't, like, when you're in split, you don't want to start putting like drop shadows everything, because you still want to be able to look at and read both apps at once and then also tap anywhere. It's kind of different to the Mac paradigm, really. So
yeah, because when you've got three apps at most, you almost want all three to be as active as possible. And the thing is, like, the cursor is one indication, but if you're wanting to use keyboard shortcuts, that's where the keyboard really comes in, then it's just your best guess at which app you touched last as to where the keyboard shortcuts will go to. And so this tells you it's this app or it's that app. And then if you want it to be the other one, then you need to touch it. You just have to touch it. But then that, it just tells you where would this keyboard shortcut go, not just like where is the cursor flashing and my typing will go to.
Yeah, I think the biggest issue with like keyboard focus on the iPad is when you're kind of, say if you're like command tabbing through spaces and then you come back to one, like, the behavior about which app it puts as the key window is not clear. Like, that's more of the issue than having the indicator itself, because it should almost be, it's hard to keep the mental model in your head, which is why the indicator is kind of required. Whereas if it was tuned differently, in your brain could just keep up with which is, you know, the most recent window, and you wouldn't even probably need the indicator to really do it, if that makes sense. So the indicator is nice, but it's certainly not like the end of the problem. But it's a nice thing for them to add, like in beta 3, and obviously it didn't exist before. So at least there's some, you know, compensation for people who've been, you know, wanting that kind of thing. Text Expander is an incredible Mac productivity tool to have in your arsenal. You can turn the things you type into reusable snippets and access them time and time again. Is there someone's name you have to write down regularly but can never remember how to spell it? Set up an acronym as a text shortcut in Text Expander and never make the same mistake. Text Expander goes beyond simple find and replace. With variables and forms, snippets are much more powerful. You can quickly stamp out an invoice, for instance, with easily editable fields to edit only the bits that need to be customized for each individual transaction. Text Expander is applicable to so many situations, from email addresses, signatures, chunks of code, form letters, even images, anywhere that you need consistent and accurate text. If you've ever written something twice, there's a good chance you could work smarter with the Text Expander snippet instead. For example, if you're a developer who has to do live presentations, you can use Text Expander to store little bits of code. Avoid embarrassing mistakes by letting Text Expander insert the code snippets as you go through your presentation straight into your IDE. You can concentrate on the core message that you're trying to get across. On the basic plan, Text Expander snippets sync across all your devices, keeping you productive at home or on the road. Text Expander is available for Mac, iPhone, iPad, Windows, and Chrome. Text Expander for Teams adds a whole extra layer for coordinating work with others. Snippets can be shared automatically across the organization, and you can even see stats about which snippets are being used more than others, so you can focus on tuning up any areas that are being ignored. Companies use Text Expander for Teams for customer support, reporting, and so much more. Listeners to this show can get 20% off their first year subscription. Visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more and sign up. That's textexpander.com/podcast.
And then, as promised, there are some changes with the watchOS 6 beta 3. What's new there?
Yeah, so obviously we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. TechCrunch had a story about Apple Watch getting the ability to delete stock apps, but it wasn't in the beta seeds at the time. It now is in the betas, at least in some capacity. It's not as many apps as you might think, and there's some weird like exceptions. For instance, you can delete the timer, you can delete the stopwatch, you can delete the alarm, but you can't delete World Clock, for instance, which is a bit random. I don't know if they're going to just get around to fixing that, because it seems like, why couldn't you delete World Clock? And then there's other apps you can delete, obviously like Cycle Tracking, ECG, and Walkie Talkie, and Breathe, and Noise. But then apps like Reminders or Mail or Find My Friends or Home or Weather, like it feels more restrictive than the apps that you can delete on the iPhone. It just seems like there's more stock apps there that could still be removed if you wanted them to be, but they don't let you. Maybe by the time that it does ship in September, they'll have opened it up to more apps, but at least we're, you know, seeing progress there. And the big ones, you know, like for me, I'm not a woman, I don't need Cycle Tracking to, you know, get in the way of my home screen grid. I'm happy I can remove it now. And also on the list view, so obviously Apple Watch has like the kind of iconic honeycomb grid of app icons, but if you long press, if you force press and switch mode, there's also just like a more standard list view where it just lists apps A to Z. In WatchOS 6, that kind of list view has got like a visual update now. It looks prettier than what they had before. Like before, it was a very like dull, dry list. Now it's more like alive and kind of got like a little magnifying effect, and the app icons are bigger. And also now you can delete apps from that list just by swiping to the left. So they've kind of improved the functionality there as well. Because in my, I think in my tech, when I covered the TechCrunch story, I was like, to delete an app on the Apple Watch, make sure you're in grid view first. But now they've removed that, you know, stepping stone by supporting a deleting of apps in both modes.
Our big criticism of the list view is that, because you and I are like in the, I think probably the smaller camp of people who prefer the honeycomb, which is a little false. But in list, you can't say like, I want these apps to be pinned to the top. And that's the obvious thing that they could improve, is like pinning apps to the top, not just alphabetical order. You know, do it alphabetical if it's not a favorited app, like a pinned app, like in Notes or something. But like full sorting would be okay too. But
because if you are going to use the list mode, you know, my current top three is Activity, Alarms, and App Store. Like for the very top of the list, it's like I don't really care for the App Store that much. I'd rather just have messages or something at the top. And at least right now, and this probably won't change in WatchOS 6, is that they don't let you sort other than just being, you know, strictly alphabetical. Whereas obviously on the home screen grid, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And they've also kind of completed the voice memos app, where before you could record a voice memo on the watch, but it didn't sync to the iPhone or iPad or Mac over iCloud, which is just like a beta issue that they let you know about. Now that works. I guess if you record on the watch, it's everywhere and vice versa. So that's cool. Closer to finishing it. And then the California watch face, this kind of gets me. I did this big story a few weeks ago about the California watch face and how you can customize the look of it really like in lots of ways to make it look nothing like a California watch face, where the, you know, it's got a mix of Roman and Arabic numerals and not showing every number, but just like some, and just really questionable if you want a standard watch look. Then you can make it look more like a modern Series 4 utility face made for that watch. And I thought it was great. And I did this big graphic image, which was like a lot of work to put together. And it was like, this is every color and style combination of the California watch face you can get. So you see all like 64 options for customization. And then in beta 3, they replace like, I think it was called off white or antique white with, it's now called cream or pink. It's like two different shades. So there's two things. And then they also added, to the black option, you can do solid black, or you can do black / every color the watch supports for other watch faces, which is like, you know, every shade of every color ever.
Yeah. Like every tint color they ever have for every watch band.
Yeah. So now I have no idea how many combinations are possible. There's no way I'm making a new graphic, and I think they even tweaked the way that other watch faces, like the existing ones, look when styled. So my graphic is like now it's a piece of a time capsule, but not what will ship. Although it didn't change the way that my favorite version of it, which is just black watch face, numerals on a circular dial with corner complications and one text complication around the dial. That's unchanged, which I'm happy about. Still no birds yet for the hourly chimes. It just reminds me of the Apple TV screensavers, where they show them at the keynote and then they're in none of the betas until it ships. Like, they played the bird sounds on stage, but then they're not in any of the betas yet. It's a very, I think, subtle chime that I can live with beyond just the tap. I keep my sound on, so I hear the chime. And maybe in beta 4, the chime gets replaced with birds and there's no option to change it back, and I've got to turn it off or I get used to the birds. But no birds yet. And this was, what was it? Kevin Lynch at the keynote showed, you know, played the demo and said, like, these are actual bird sounds caught in Apple Park.
Yeah. We recorded these outside.
Like, yeah. No birds were harmed.
I'll just go on the record. I'd be perfectly happy if they never ship, because as soon as they play those sounds, I'm like, these are going to be so annoying.
I am loving the ability, like I hear a sound and I know what time it is, because I've seen the time recently enough that I know it isn't like an hour, because I'm doing it every half hour. I love it. I'm carrying groceries upstairs and my watch chimes and gives me the tap and I'm like, oh, it's 6:30, because the last time I saw the clock, it was, you know, after 6 o'clock and it's not 7 yet. And it's just like in mental, like time tracking and like how I'm doing throughout the day. It really helps me. So I know that you don't use it. I love it. And I'm hoping that we don't get birds. Or if we do get birds, we get this option to keep this subtle chime too. I'm tracking it. And then I wanted to share one story that's kind of half complete. But, you know, again, the reason I was traveling last week was to run in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution Peachtree Road Race 10K in Atlanta. And, I was running the watchOS 6 beta 3 and, did not bring my iPhone along for the race, because my ideal run, you know, method is just the Apple Watch and an external heart monitor to save battery, and then like AirPods or Powerbeats headphones, earphones to play music. But we got to the race super early because of just the number of people that were going to be there, 60,000. You need to be there early to avoid like traffic jams. We got there like 3 hours before our start time, which I think was a little bit too early, but it worked out. At one point, the group of people I was with said, the Starbucks opens at 7 a.m. We should get coffee from there when that opens, because we got there at 5:30 a.m. And I thought, oh, I don't have my wallet on me, because I didn't carry that either, and or keys or anything, just had the watch. And I remember I didn't have my debit or credit card set up on the Apple Watch. I just had like the Apple Pay Cash card, which I don't keep a balance on. And so I thought to myself, I'll download the Starbucks app from the App Store, because that lets you you can put money on your card that way with Apple Pay. It was just a neat instance of like, oh, this is where having an app on the watch is useful. What happened was I could download the Starbucks app on the watch, but I couldn't sign in because it's not updated for the watch yet. You know, watchOS 6. And even then, like maybe it'll require you to first initially like log in from the iPhone. Anyway, we'll see.
Yeah, on watchOS 6, Apple added text fields, but when you show them, they basically just tell you to type it on the phone. It's kind of like the notification you get when you can enter a text field on the Apple TV, and it shows up on the phone and lets you type it in there. That's basically what they're doing for text fields on the watch.
Yeah. So that didn't quite work out for me, but it was like an almost instance of having the App Store on the watch is the future.
You got a glimpse of the future. Yeah,
I got a glimpse of it if they just complete the story there. What I actually ended up doing when I thought that we were going to go for coffee, which we actually didn't do, which annoyed me, but I messaged someone and I said, can you send me $20 of the cash? I'll send it back to you when I'm through the race. And then they did over iMessage. And then I could have bought coffee that way.
Why don't you just put your like bank cards on your watch?
I do, but because the number of times I've reset the watch during the beta period, to add them back, you've got to put in your CVC number, and I just later, and I always forget. So since then, I put them back on the card, and I don't think I'll be resetting my watch anytime soon. But yeah, you can see, and there's so many changes in watchOS 6 where you've got like all these settings that used to have to go to the phone for, and now they're on the watch. And it's just like, they did a lot of work for that, I think, in this update. And it doesn't get a lot of discussion because it isn't like you can do something new. It's just that you can do something in a different way. And and it's not even because you can now have a watch without an iPhone. Like you still need the iPhone. But it's at least doing like groundwork this year that will be needed in a future year if they ever go without the iPhone.
One of the things, by the way, that you can do in watchOS 6 now is, you know, the feature where you can make an app like be the session app, and it always shows on the watch face if something's happening. Where you like, so like a music app, right? You can see like the music app's watch app pop up, or you get the now playing card pop up. What you can actually do now, there's one of the settings is it lets you enable or toggle off on an app-by-app basis whether an app can do that. So you could have now playing and podcasts show their native interfaces, but say if you know, you didn't want the Overcast Watch app, you just want now playing, you could turn it off for Overcast only. And that applies to like all this. There's like a big long list, and you can do it on, I think you can do it on the watch or on the companion phone app.
So. Yeah, and you can do it for workout. You can do it for like other workout apps like Nike Run Club. And with the app deletion, you can delete now playing, which since it's an app now, it's deletable. I haven't tried it and seen how it affects like how now playing works. But maybe it just sends you to the now playing screen from the app that it's pulling from anyway. I don't know. But yeah,
it does nothing.
It does nothing. Yeah. That's a cool change though. Also in the new betas this week, I'm not sure that we're forgetting anything, but the last thing that we have kind of observed was that the tvOS 13 beta 3 has this jarring new app launch animation. So describe that to me.
Right. So previously on the Apple TV, when you launch an app from the home screen, the home screen grid icons would kind of like fly forward and the interface of the app would come from behind, like as if it's emerging from below. Whereas now what they've done is they've made it more like an iPhone or iPad app launch animation, where you kind of zoom into the app icon you've clicked on and it morphs into the iPhone UI as it fills to fill the screen. So they've kind of gone from like the layering to zooming in and out of an icon. I don't have Apple TV betas, but I've obviously seen like the videos. To me, it looks more janky and just, I don't know, it doesn't have the same kind of fluidity that I like associate with tvOS, yeah. If you know what I mean.
I have the betas, and it's on the Apple TV 4K, which is the fastest Apple TV they make, and I don't like it. Like, I see where they're coming from, where it feels more like apps launching on every other platform, but on the TV size screen, I think it, for me, it introduces, like, I call it jarring because it does feel like you're being swished around, like you're watching like a 3D movie or something, and it's like pulling you all over depending on the angle of.
It's almost like too much motion.
Yeah, like if the icon's in the bottom right corner, you're getting like swished around that way, or if it's in the top right, you're going that way, and it's just like, it's really jarring because it goes from like a corner to the full screen, and the TVs are quite big. And I think it's like a version of what people saw with early iOS 7 versions, where, but even that's like on a phone screen in front of you. Like on the TV, it's even more immersive in a bad way. And then my just sort of like that, that's like my taste preference, but then I think it takes more time because it has to play out in front of you in a way that the other animation wasn't quite as lengthy. So I hope this is like a one-off experiment in this beta version and then changes, because I'm not sure that they've moved the ball forward here in terms of how everything works and looks.
Yeah, I can see what they were going for, but I don't think the execution is there. It doesn't quite work.
Yep. And we began this segment with talking about a new screensaver for the first time in maybe a decade. Let's end it with a new app from Apple, which is Texas Hold'em version 2.0. This is literally an update to Texas Hold'em from Apple, which has been gone from the App Store for a long time. Like, I don't think it ever went Retina, did it?
Nope. But
they had version 1.0 and version 1.1, and that was it. And now they got version 2.0, and it's on the App Store. It's the new version of that app. Just like, I think like several months ago, what's the popular bare bones software text editor?
BB Edit.
Yeah, BB Edit returned to the app, to the Mac App Store, and it was the same like store page that had all the old reviews from like 5 years ago. It was just an update to that app. This is the same way. It's an update to the original, like the old Apple game for the iPhone and iPod Touch. Now it's back, and it roots back to the iPod, like the classic style iPod with a click wheel, and it was like a game on that. They ported it into the App Store as like a demonstration of what the App Store can be. And they kind of pitched this in the release, which is like, we're doing this because the App Store has turned 10. It's the 10th anniversary of the App Store, so this is in celebration of that. Then there was a lot of frustration from people in the community about that messaging, because the App Store is about to turn 11. So it would in some ways make more sense to say because the App Store is 11. I viewed it as fine because the App Store is 10. 10's a milestone. 11's a higher number, but like we look at round numbers and we love those. And it's still in the 10th year, even though it's almost the 11th. And I don't think like it got delayed or it was like, you know, some major problems until now. I think it's just like someone had the time to do it and they just attached the 10th anniversary from last year as like the reason for it, even though it was probably kind of random. but people were quite annoyed at that messaging and saying 10th anniversary when we're about to hit the 11th. I thought it was too much overthinking it for a simple game that's just all in fun.
Yeah, it's a fun, nice little throwback, right? And you can still go into the players and find Phil Schiller. Like, all of those players are, like, old Apple employees, and Schiller and stuff are still there with his eye patch. Just, you can just play along or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a better game than Warren Buffett's Paper Wizard.
Yeah.
We've all read some surprising online reviews, right? Whether you're trying to get a sweet deal on something you've been saving for or trying to find the best happy hour in town, it's generally a good idea to read reviews first. So why should finding the right software for your business be any different? Read thousands of real software reviews and find the right software for your business at Captera.com/happy hour. Not familiar with Captera? Captera is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 850,000 reviews of products from real software users, you can discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories covering the entire range of business needs, from project management to email marketing to even running your own yoga studio. There's something there for everyone. No matter what kind of software you're looking for, get your business off the ground, or simply optimize existing workflows, Captera makes it easy to discover the right solution, and fast. How'd you get started? Go to Captera.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web with endless Google searches. Captera brings everything together into one simple-to-browse business directory. Join the millions of people who use Captera each month to find the right tools for their business. Visit Captera.com/happy hour for free today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Captera.com/happy hour. Captera, CAPTERRA.com/happy hour. Software selection simplified.
All right, Mayo, and if all of that wasn't enough, on Tuesday we got, I would say, like, gigantic news about the MacBook lineup. New MacBook Airs, a new version of the entry-level MacBook Pro, and the death of the 12-inch MacBook. So let's recap what's new for pricing and features for the MacBook Air and MacBook Pro.
Yeah, so it was actually, this kind of came out of nowhere. We did have a slight tip-off when the FCC had that 13-inch MacBook show up a few days ago. And we were like, what's this about? And we thought maybe, oh, it's that rumored one with the 32 gigs of RAM, but clearly now it's this new, you know, touch bar entry level MacBook Pro. There was quite a lot of changes, really. For the MacBook Air, they have reduced the price by $100. So now it's $1099 instead of $1199. And it's $999. So they're getting below the $1,000, you know, sub $1,000 if you're a student. So if you get a student education pricing, you can get it for $999, which is fantastic. They did add True Tone to the screen, but otherwise the hardware is unchanged. It's the same. It's a small revision to the 2018 MacBook Air, but you know the big thing is the price. Like when the 2018 MacBook Air came out, everyone was hoping, people had pinned their hopes on, me included, about, oh, this is going to be the time that Apple's going to be able to simplify the line. They're going to be able to kill off the non-Retina MacBook Air with this new replacement model. But then when it came out and it was, you know, significantly more expensive, it left Apple in a bit of a lurch, and they couldn't get rid of it. Whereas now, it is giving them the confidence to kill off the non-Retina MacBook Air, because for, you know, general consumers, it's $1099, and then for education, they got the price down to the magic $999 number. So yeah, that is a big deal, even if it is mainly just a price difference.
Mm-hmm.
For the 13-inch MacBook Pro, what they've done essentially is taken the non-touch bar MacBook Pro and given it a touch bar. So it's the same price, it's $1,299. It now has 8th generation processors, Intel processors. It has a touch bar now, which means it also has Touch ID and the T2 Apple security chip. And it has True Tone as well. The $1,299 and the $1,499 13-inch configurations are the two-port models. You have to go all the way up to the $1,799 to get to the previous Touch Bar MacBook Pros, which were the $1,799 ones.
Mm-hmm.
This allows them to kind of simplify the line in a pretty big way, because now you don't have the non-Retina Air anymore. You don't have the weird non-touch bar, like MacBook Escape, like the MacBook Pro without the escape key. Now, every MacBook Pro has a touch bar, which is kind of a cool setup. Like, you have the MacBook Air, which has Touch ID still, but, you know, Pro, MacBook Pro, touch bar, okay? And you can get into a touch bar now from $1,299, which is a pretty good price. Mm-hmm. But it also means that they have, in the process, kind of sorted out or resolved the weirdness and kind of clash in that kind of 12, 13-inch range by killing off the 12-inch entirely. So the non-Retina Air isn't sold anymore, and the 12-inch MacBook is not, which was the one-port USB-C model, is gone. And obviously now the weirdness of the non-touch bar MacBook Pro is also gone. So now you basically just have a line of MacBook Air, you have a line of 13-inch MacBook Pro, and then you have a line of 15-inch MacBook Pro. So yeah. It's pretty good.
And Pro sort of now always means not a wedge shape, but has touch bar, since that's true of every MacBook Pro now. And then Air is defined as no touch bar, but you get Touch ID and it has a wedge shape. And that's the lineup now. And it's true that the Air getting True Tone and lower pricing, it didn't get the process is the same, right?
Yeah. Okay. Otherwise, I don't know. Cool.
And it only has one processor, like that. You don't have options to spec it out, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. And then the MacBook Pro that gained the Touch Bar, now it does have an upgrade processor. So that went a little while on old processors, and now it's finally updated. So that was more needed than on the Air, at least.
Yeah. The entry level 1299 processor is 1.4 gigahertz quad core, mm-hmm. So it might still be a little slow, but should be okay for like casual use, really.
Maybe not pro, but casual use.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Apple's confused the messaging around Pro so much in the last like decade. You go back to like 2008, 2009, Apple at that time made a big deal about getting rid of the MacBook and upgrading it to the MacBook Pro name, and all that really consisted of was giving it a few extra ports and making the screen black glossy. Do you remember when they did that, right? Like, yeah, it was basically the same laptop. They just put like black glossy surrounds on the screen.
Yeah, so I started college in 2009. I graduated high school in 2009, went to college that fall. And my roommate, I think his grandparents bought his Mac for him like around high school graduation as like a college gift. And so he got the 13-inch MacBook that was silver, and they also sold the white plastic MacBook, but the 13-inch MacBook was like, you know, it was newer, it looked newer. But then a few months later, my grandparents bought my Mac for college, and it was the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and I think it had like maybe it had the SD card slot, yeah. And the MacBook that was also silver looked just like it didn't. And he was so jealous that I had like the better one than him when they were both bought that summer.
Yeah, so the whole Pro not really being Pro Rodeo has been going a long time. Obviously, it just means it's the higher tier thing. And now we've got a decent separation of, you know, touch bars and every current MacBook Pro. But yeah, the processor situation, if you are looking at these, you might want to, you know, either wait for some reviews or consider going up the chain a little bit, because at least on the stock configurations, not considering the build to order options, you don't actually get beyond the 1.4 gigahertz quad core processor until you spend $1,799. So there is quite the $1,299 price is attractive, but at least on Apple's, you know, this is what you buy at the store. The upgraded processor doesn't come into effect until you spend a lot more money.
Yeah, I showed you this story on Happy Hour before, but it was like in 2016, December, the day after Christmas, I was in a Best Buy buying a drone, and it was a family in front of me in line, and it was mom and dad and daughter, and they were returning the daughter's Christmas MacBook Pro 2016 model. Because it wasn't the touch bar model, and that's what she actually wanted. And they bought like the entry level model with no touch bar. And so they had to go up from what, 1300 to the 1800 to get touch bar.
Yep.
And when that's all she wanted, because that, you know, that before we had any idea of what touch bar could offer us, she probably could have been fine with this entry level model instead. It hasn't existed until now.
Yeah. And some people would see this shrinking of the lineup as a disadvantage, because people bemoan the lack of like a physical escape key and stuff. So, mm-hmm. you know, going touch bar exclusive on all MacBook Pros might be considered a backstep for some people. I think it's fine. Like, I'm a coder and a developer, and the thing about the escape key for me is because it's top left, it's in a reliable position, right? If you were dependent on the function keys that go in between, like the escape key and the power button, then yeah, the touch bar is a regression because obviously you don't get like the physical feedback and you can't like feel where the keys are necessarily. And obviously if you have it on the dynamic mode, it's always changing around. But, you know, escape's always top left and I never miss it. So at least in my experience, if you're worried about that, I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, I haven't had a touch bar in a while. It's not often that I miss it for any specific reason other than that I still think it is kind of futuristic looking and the dynamic, changes that it has are interesting. But without having used one in a while, the only thing I would want out of it to be better is that it always just seems like low resolution compared to like other Retina screens. Isn't it just kind of fuzzy it's never changed?
I think if you actually look at the maths, it's 220 PPI, which is the same as the actual LCD screen. But I do agree it doesn't look the same. It kind of reminds me of like a Kindle e-ink screen in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like a bit like, it's like the pixels are like circular rather than square. I don't know. It's a weird finish. In terms of my usage of the touch bar, you know, I basically never use it. Like, I do very little. The only times I occasionally use it are like when you're doing an adjustment in Photos and you have to like change the orientation of the image, like the rotation. And it's so nice to be able to just like slide the slider back and forth. So, you know, it gets occasional use from me, but I think we said this on the show before, like the best use cases of the touch bar are for people that aren't like good touch typists, right? Like if you're going away from the pros and further down the line, you know, closer to like a more casual user base, casual price point, that's actually where the touch bar has potential to actually be used, because then you're constantly looking down at the keys and constantly looking at the bar. Whereas me, I'm always just looking straight ahead. So especially in the 1299 mod, Apple might find that the touch bar has more use in general than, you know, in the pro configurations.
Yeah, well, that's something we've definitely discussed on the show before.
It's like when you're going to bring it more to
consumers, they'll be happier with it. For me, the thing I from had one before, not now, I recall in Logic, the pro app, being able to switch the modes of what the cursor is, whether it's a pointer or a slicer, things like that, that it was more efficient on the touch bar because it was like a button that you press versus like, you know, UI on the screen that you find and navigate through. But that was kind of the only like single use that I agree with you with Photos. You can do some cool things there too. But that's about it. My take has always been that I wouldn't turn it down if it were the same price and included, but I also like wouldn't pay extra for it. But it was a step back for me because escape key, virtual, physical, whatever, function keys, hardly use those. And then now with like, you know, play pause controls, it used to always be iTunes. Now it's like whatever app you've used most recently with iTunes going away. And that's clearer on the touch bar when you've got the app icon as an indicator for whether it's Safari or, you know, music, podcasts, Spotify, whatever. That's clearer on a touch bar.
Yeah. And you always have like you're kind of keeping the door open to a potential future where Apple like changes the touch bar software significantly to try and make it more useful in general, like by putting more static items on it. And you know, that they haven't done that, you know, in 3 or 4 years since it's come out. But say if you buy a laptop today and you keep it for 4 years, it's not out of the question that, you know, by the time 2022 comes around, one of these macOS random California cities or places does actually pay attention to the touch bar again and get, you know, kind of switch it up the paradigm. So I would definitely, I would not shy away from getting a touch bar again. I'm fine with a touch bar, but I wouldn't be like, I wouldn't pick the 1299 MacBook Pro over the Air because of the touch bar, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about this 12-inch MacBook going away now. I think the majority of people look at this happening and say, that makes sense. The 12-inch MacBook was a terrible machine. It was confusing in the lineup. It cost way too much. There were cheaper, better computers. It made no sense after the MacBook Air came back. But I know people who use it still today. I use one exclusively for months and got real work done on it. And there are still things about it that are just better than what a MacBook Air can do. And it introduced a lot of things that were first for the Mac that live on through the modern Air and modern Pro. And so I wrote a piece called Apple Killed Its Most Futuristic Mac with No True Upgrade. And the thing about it for me is that if you go back and watch the presentation, there are so many firsts that came with the MacBook 12-inch, right? Without, before there was a new MacBook Air and before there was a new MacBook Pro. Ignore the keyboard because that lives on in all of the other Macs today. There's no new keyboard yet, so they didn't kill it because of that. Those still exist, and even the new Macs that just came out this week. But like, it was the first to replace MagSafe charging with USB charging, which is still in every Mac now, MacBook now. It was the first to have auto boot up whenever you open the lid. It starts up as a part of that. Like, you get rid of the chime, but on all Macs now, you open up the Mac, the notebook, and it boots up if it's turned off. That's something that was first with this. It was the first to do space gray as a finish and gold. Before that, all Macs were silver. It was the first that had a display too thin for the back Apple logo. That goes away with this Mac, but it's on every other Mac notebook now. And even things like it had a stacked battery, like sheets of battery that were crammed in there to make it, you know, have as much power
what
as possible.
What do they call it? Terrace? Is it terrace battery?
Yeah. And that seems to be like, they talked about like they developed that for this Mac so that they could have as much battery life and the small form factor as possible. Did they ever do anything like that for other Macs or iPads or iPhones?
There were rumors that they wanted to do it for the MacBook Pro, but I don't think they did. Like,
yeah, same.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the current lineup does not do it.
Yeah, but even the logic board was like the smallest ever in a Mac, mm-hmm. and it was the only Mac to be fanless. The MacBook Air has a fan, which can get very loud if you put it under, you know, pressure. So I feel like
USB Type-C?
Yeah, USB Type-C. Yeah. Didn't have Thunderbolt yet, but even the trackpad, like it was the first to have that gigantic Force Touch trackpad. And even if Force Touch isn't like adopted widely in Mac OS, even from Apple, it was still the first to have the modern design of like the not diving board style,
yeah,
where you can click anywhere, which is a big improvement.
Yeah, I really love the trackpads as they are at the moment. They're great. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the 12-inch introduced the butterfly keyboard.
Right.
Yeah. Less of a success.
Yeah. The thing about that, though, is just the fact that it's still on all the new Macs that they're making this week, even. It's like,
yep.
That wasn't a shining moment, but it's also, it lives on past the MacBook that introduced it, you know? So it isn't like it would almost make sense if the MacBook kept it always and then the other Macs didn't have it. And you were like, I don't want that one because of the keyboard, but it's just that one Mac, ignore it, you know? But the thing for me is that since the MacBook Air came out, they had three generations of the MacBook, the 12-inch MacBook. They were always from $1,300. It was the 2015 version, 2016, and 2017. There was no new MacBook in 2018. Instead, there was the MacBook Air, and it costs less, which was kind of weird because it had a bigger screen and Touch ID that the MacBook didn't have, and it had two ports instead of one, and both with Thunderbolt 3. So that was a pretty tough compare. Do you want to spend $1,200 or $1,300, you know? And if you spend more, you get a smaller screen. But the thing was, you also got more storage mm-hmm. on the MacBook because it only started at 256, whereas all the Macs now can start at 128 for less money. And that was before they dropped the price of storage. And what's the storage story this year, this week?
It's 128, I think.
But they dropped storage costs.
Like, oh, right. Yeah. So across the line, like whether you're talking about these new Macs or the iMac Pro or anything, the higher end storage options are like half the price of what they were the day before. So like the 4 terabyte SSD in the iMac Pro used to be like $2,400, now it's $1,200. 1 terabyte used to be $1,200, now it's $600. Like mm-hmm. basically Apple's SSD upgrade options are still expensive, but they're more in the realm of like Apple's normal exorbitance compared to, you know, the industry. Like, yeah. Apple's like the only company where they could halve the price of something and it still be considered expensive. But yeah. That's kind of where we are. But it's still, you know, it's still reassuring and nice to see that they have actually done that now. So
it's literally something you've been talking about for a long time.
Yeah. And they could have gone lower potentially, but it's definitely now more in like the realm of the normal Apple price premium for, mm-hmm. you know, inbuilt upgrades versus before where it was actually just getting like ludicrous the amount of difference. Like, just the simple fact that they can halve the price of like so many of the upgrades is just, it just shows you that, you know, they were penny dipping for a while.
Yeah. But my thing with the MacBook is that now there's no Mac that thin and light, which is a feature for a lot of people that like, it's very discreet to use it in public on a plane or just like at a coffee shop. It's so portable, even more than the MacBook Air. And there's no silent Mac anymore. There's like, every other Mac is a fan, and now they get rid of this one. And maybe that was an issue, and they couldn't put enough speed in it. But you could spec it out pretty well. You could get faster processors. You could get 16 gigabytes of RAM. You get a lot of storage. You just paid a price for it all. But if they gave the MacBook, instead of killing it, even without changing the processor in it, if they just said, we're going to do new storage prices, and we're going to start it at 128 like every other Mac that we sell, even pros, then you could see it being a better, like cheaper than the MacBook Air. So it could be priced at $999 for 128, and for education $899, which would be a pretty sweet price. Instead, it goes away, and that would have made more sense because it's like it's $100 cheaper than the MacBook Air. You get the same storage. You just choose your features. Do you want ultra portable or portable? With Touch ID, you know, and a little bit more screen real estate. So I really hope that this is the end of like the computer forever. You know, like the vision is bring it back when you have ARM Macs so that it can have like super good battery life, because that was one thing the MacBook Air had, better battery life too. You know, maybe if you could do cellular, you know, for the first time, you had 4G or 5G inside, because they're using ARM, they've got more control over that and the chip reliability. It was also the first Mac to go all metal. So like before the MacBook, there was always that plastic hinge. Mm-hmm. But then with the MacBook, they were able to do like an all metal hinge on the back. So it just looks even nicer than the plastic ones. So I hope there's a future for it. I know our colleague Michael Steeper still uses one. And I've heard of lots of other people that use them too, like primarily. And the sweet solution for me was like the MacBook for mobile work, not all your work, but mobile work, and then an iMac for at home, so that you're like, you can have a single Mac, you know, have a 15 inch MacBook Pro, and that's one machine for everywhere you go. But it isn't like the most, it's not optimized for portability, and it's not even optimized for like ergonomics at a desk. You know, you get a better experience with a big screen iMac and then the super portable MacBook. And so for me, I'm bummed to see it go. And I did go from MacBook to MacBook Air.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're one of the defectors, though. Like, you had the MacBook, but, and you're like, nah, I don't want this anymore.
Yeah, but that's because they didn't update it. Like, if they would have updated it, then I would have been like, oh, I want the newer, you know, faster MacBook. Like, ignore the MacBook Air. And there just never was a time where the MacBook Air was new and the MacBook was new. It was the MacBook Air is new. The MacBook is from last year. So if you want that, wait until next year to buy it. Oops, next year we're going to kill it off. So I think like, if you didn't ever want the computer, then this makes perfect sense to you. If you bought one and regretted it, then it makes perfect sense to you. But if you bought one and liked it, then what you really wanted was them to continue updating it, like have a fourth generation model. Who cares if it has Touch ID or Touch Bar? Just give us a faster version of what you have, because every other Mac is getting updated these days. Instead, they killed it. And I agree with that. They cleaned up the Mac lineup in so many ways that it makes way more sense now. But it's even with Air being the name of the heavier one, I could get around that and say, but MacBook is like where you start out with. And it wasn't just that it was more pricey because it was miniaturization and it had this new battery tech. Like, that's the cost in the beginning, but eventually like that levels out. And it could be cheaper if you have the storage and then lower the price of that halved storage. So
yeah, it's hard because like, right, in, you know, Apple, I like it when Apple was decisive and makes choices, right? And for a long time, the Mac line, the MacBook line specifically, it kind of felt like they were like pandering to everyone they could and just keeping stuff around for the, you know, because some people bought it, and it led to a confusing lineup. And, you know, what they have done this week is they've got rid of the non-Retina Air, and they've got rid of some of the confusion around that 12-inch, 13-inch size by getting rid of the 12-inch MacBook entirely, and also eliminating the, you know, the gap of that entry-level 13-inch MacBook Pro as well. So there are definitely going to be some people who are now no longer served, like if you're already super fan of the ultra-thin and light form factor, at least until Apple does something again in the future where they bring it back with ARM or whatever else. But, you know, this is kind of what Apple's like. I feel like this is almost when Apple's is best, when it's like making choices that aren't like catering to every single legacy market, and they and the end result now is a lineup that's way cleaner than what they've had.
Well,
for,
I think not catering to like a legacy market would have been to continue updating the MacBook and bringing the cost down, bringing the features up, and then not doing the MacBook Air, which I think is like a total. Yeah, you know, I mentioned this when it was brand new. To call it a MacBook Air is tricky because, like, one thing that means Air is that it's a wedge shape. Well, so is the MacBook.
Yeah.
But Air also meant Thunderbolt, so it got that. But SD card reader's gone. Like, you know, regular USB's gone. It didn't, and it got a worse webcam. You know, it went Retina, but less screen real estate. So I feel like what happened here was they thought that the MacBook, the way they framed out the keynote was, this is our chance to reinvent the notebook. That was the phrase that was on the slide. And they did that. Like, every other MacBook that exists now is modeled after this MacBook, for better or worse. The pros are all like specced up versions of this. You know, the MacBook Air is a thicker specced up version of this. And then this goes away. And that just feels so weird to me. Like, to go from a MacBook to a new MacBook Air is not a clear upgrade. For one, you might have less storage unless you pay more, which stinks. But also, you've got a fan that will come on at times. You do get better battery life. You do get a little bit more screen real estate, but like, it's 1.3 inches more. It's not massive, and it's not as light. It's not as portable. It's less discreet in public. So
yeah, you get Touch ID, but realistically, if they would have cared for the MacBook, they could have put Touch ID on the 12 inch as well.
So. Yeah. And the watch, if you wear an Apple Watch, it takes over so much of what Touch ID can be used for.
I think what's surprising to me is that rather than solidifying the MacBook in that 13 inch price point by getting rid of the non-touch bar MacBook Pro and just leaving the 13 inch MacBook Pro starting at like the $1,499 level, which is kind of what I thought the obvious move was, you know, if you rewind a week ago, instead they got rid of the MacBook and solidified the MacBook Pro at the $1,299 level with the touch bar. Like, that's kind of where the strange decision comes in for me, is that and we don't know how many of like each of these things they sell, but it didn't seem like the 12 inch was a flop, right? Like, it felt like it was a decent contender.
I see them in the wild. Yeah.
So it's definitely weird. If you'd have told me, oh, they're going to simplify the Mac line, what are they going to do? I would have said they're going to kill off that $1,299 MacBook Pro. But, you know, they killed off the $1,299 MacBook and then gave the MacBook Pro, a load of features for the same price. Like, it was definitely a weird approach. I think the end result is okay. And, look, you know, some people are going to be upset and annoyed that the MacBook's gone away. Realistically, I don't think it's going to be very long until something comes back in to fill in the gap. Like, maybe 2020, the ARM stuff starts happening. And whether it's called MacBook or MacBook Air or whatever they call it, you know, it's going to be super thin and light and not have a fan, right? So the gap is maybe not too long. And say if Apple wasn't going to update the computer anyway in that time frame, like they didn't do last year, maybe it's just better that it doesn't exist for a while and then can return in, you know, in glory with it being new and modern versus, you know,
I hope we get some reporting on that soon so that we can know that's what's going to happen versus right now where it's like, maybe it will, but maybe it won't.
Apple is 100% going to have a fanless laptop again because they love having no moving parts computers, right?
Well, Johnny did, but he's gone.
That was hilarious when people were like, look, all this stuff's happening. Now Johnny's out the door. Like, come on.
Yeah, praise Jeff. I don't know. But the thing is, like, also, when the MacBook first came out, that was before the 12.9-inch iPad was on the market by like several months, because that was, it was March versus November.
Yeah.
For launch at least. And it's like, you can do more now on an iPad Pro than you could at the time, you know, especially with iPadOS 13 coming. And the smart keyboard situation has improved. Like, with the first smart keyboard was terrible in your lap. It was just really top heavy and it bent in the middle. They've improved that with the last version of the smart keyboard where it's more lap friendly. But you just cannot beat a clamshell notebook in terms of like ergonomics, where the screen's adjustable from several angles. The keyboard doesn't bend or flop. It's like, it's as supportive as the lid is. It's more supportive even. It's not top heavy. It's bottom heavy. And it's not heavy at all, really. Like, and just Mac OS. Like, you could have, it was a very portable version of Mac OS with like a dozen windows on your screen with like mission control switching and everything versus three apps on your screen at once on an iPad and so much swiping. Like, I just don't feel like the iPad has as good as it's getting, has caught up with what this MacBook could do.
I'm not going to disagree with you on that one.
Yeah. So I'm frustrated by this, even though I didn't have one for the last year. I would say that was mainly because they didn't make a new version of it. And if they had continued to make one, like, especially with having an iMac Pro at home as like the main thing, then optimizing for portability for the secondary computer is really ideal. So I hate to see it go. And I think the majority was just like good riddance, but it's worth, you know, praising its history and what it brought to all the Macs that have outlived it now, and that it had such an unfair exit where it was never apples to apples comparison to the MacBook Air, where you could say like, let's give the MacBook Air this amount of storage and the Mac this amount of storage and see which one sells more. It was always like an unfair comparison. Even if you ignore that one was older than the other one, it was just so tricky. So.
Yeah, the scales were always weirdly tilted. Mm-hmm. But at least we're coming out at the end of it now with finally a MacBook lineup that at least is sensible when you look at the range, right? Like, you can blank out the 12-inch from your mind and you see a nice clear step. You see the MacBook Air, right? You can clearly define that product in your head or when you're walking in the Apple Store as a consumer. And then you have a line of MacBook Pros then they all have the touch bar. They all look the same. They all basically work the same. They're just, you know, slower, 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 fast. It is a much nicer lineup when you come at the other end, even if they have like dropped some market segment along the way.
Yeah. And if you think the single port issue was the problem, well, guess what else has a single USB port? The iPad Pro. So if it works for that, it can work for this Mac. Oh, well. All right. Last thing on the Mac section for what like the news is this week. What is the back to school promotion this year?
Shocker. It's free Beats again. Yeah. It's just basically the same deal they always do. If you buy iPad Air, iPad Pro, or any Mac apart from the Mac Mini, you can get a free pair of Beats headphones. Obviously, the cheaper computers just get like Beats X or Power Beats or Beats Solo 3. And then what is slightly new for this year is that at the high end, you can actually get Beats Studio 3. So like their most expensive, you know, newly updated with the active noise cancelling over-ear headphones. They're now as part of the back to school offer.
Yeah,
and obviously you get the free Beats on top of the discount. So if you're buying like the new MacBook Air, you can get the $100 off to make it $999. Plus you can get the Solo 3s, which is, you know, a pretty good deal if you're a student.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you get discount on Apple Care as well if you buy that. No one gets Power Beats Pro, so you get Power Beats like 3, whatever they're called, with the cord, the wireless corded version. But no one gets Power Beats Pro, which makes sense since there's such a high demand and quantity is still so limited and they don't have colors out yet, just black. My theory on Beats Studio 3 is two things that this could be about. It often feels like they're like the back to school promotion is like a way to get rid of some old inventory. And so maybe they're clearing Beats Studio 3 inventory before they discontinue those. And then they have the Apple branded over the ear headphones.
Okay, yeah.
Yep. Or less interesting, but Beats Studio 4. And what would that be? You go from the W1 chip to the H1 chip, which the Power Beats Pro have, new AirPods have. You know, all the benefits of that with lower latency, faster switching, that kind of thing. That could be Beats Studio 4. And so they're giving away free Beats Studio 3s because they're making room for this fall for one of those two products. Of course, the Apple ones have been rumored and the timing could be later this fall, early next year, sometime next year. But I can't help but think because this is the first time they're doing Beats Studio 3, right?
Yep.
As a giveaway. Yep. So that's my guess.
Okay. You could also just say that they always just shove the free Beats in because clearly like the Beats Studio 3 is probably costing the same as like AirPods to make and they're not going to get rid of AirPods anytime soon. It's just, they just kind of like, you know, you can get the second tier headphones. If you want the new super cool, truly wireless ones, you can buy them with your own money.
Yeah.
Because obviously Beats X have been on the free rotation for years now without an update. So
that's true. Yeah. All right. What's going on with Quo? And what happens with these new keyboards and or MacBooks?
Yeah, it's kind of in a bit of a lurch, really, because before you know, all of Apple's announcements, there was this Minchi Kuo report out that said Apple was going to adopt a scissor switch keyboard as reinforced with glass fibers for better durability, apparently. And he said that was coming to first the 2019 MacBook Air, followed by, quote, partially refreshed MacBook Pros in early 2020. Obviously now the 2019 MacBook Air is, we think, out. And it seems unlikely that they're going to change the MacBook Air within, you know, a matter of months. Like, it'd only be like 3 months and then they would change the keyboard out on it. So if the quote reports come true. So it definitely, like, puts the validity of this particular report in jeopardy, really, because not only have they addressed a 2019 MacBook Air, they've also again give another, you know, what seems like a partial refresh to the MacBook Pros. So unless there are other, like, maybe there are other MacBook Pro updates coming in the fall separate to the 16-inch MacBook Pro that do get a new keyboard, but Quo was very specific in that you'll come to the MacBook Air first, and we've seen the MacBook Air update and it doesn't have a new keyboard.
Apple tells press that this is the same keyboard that came from the new MacBook Pros earlier this year around May, right? Mm-hmm. And they qualify for the same repair program where if this keyboard is, you know, wonky in the first, what is it, 3 years?
4 years, yeah.
Four years, even without AppleCare, you can have it serviced for free.
Yeah,
it's a weird one. Quo's been wrong before. Like, I think the thing that sounds to me is when Quo says that it was going to be a new iMac last year, and there was no new iMac last year, and he said it would have some, the specificity was like that the, like, it would have some new
display performance upgrade.
Yeah, and instead what happened was, like, a few weeks later the MacBook Pro got True Tone, and we seem to think that was, like, where the wires got crossed. This could be like that, where there's something to it, but we don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, Quo isn't perfect, but he is obviously very good. So
yeah, and for the MacBook Air, like, this is it got True Tone, it got better pricing, but it did not get a faster chip. So there's still room for, like, in the fall, oh, newer chips available. Let's put that in there, and the keyboard's different. But I have to imagine that a new keyboard comes with just a wholly new design for something, and not, you know, stick it in the existing casing.
Yeah, it doesn't really seem like a retrofit job, if that.
Right.
I mean,
they can't even retrofit every butterfly keyboard between generations.
Yeah. So if you're just an average consumer and you look on, like, the tech specs page for the MacBook Air, it won't tell you that it's a butterfly keyboard. There's one reference to a butterfly keyboard in the entire, like, MacBook Air site. So, you know, if you're not in the tech circle, Apple could maybe just get away with silently changing the keyboards in the fall and, like. Look, the keyboard situation is problematic, and at some point they're going to have to upset some people to get it fixed, right? Like, at some point, that's just going to what's going to have to happen.
There will be someone who bought the last version of the bad keyboard,
yeah,
before the moment before a new keyboard is announced.
Regardless of what product it's on, right? And this butterfly situation has been going on for so long now. There might just be this mentality inside of Apple where it's like, as soon as we're ready to sort it out, just do it and start putting it on all of our computers and get these stupid butterfly warranty programs out of our head, right? And if that's the case, oh, well, we've had to sell this MacBook Air for 3 months before we change the keyboard out on it. And if obviously the tech price is going to go wild when the keyboard changes, but the tech price is going to go wild when the keyboard changes regardless of the situation, whether it's on the 16-inch MacBook Pro, whether it's on the 15-inch MacBook Pro, whether it's on the MacBook Air, regardless of what it's on. As soon as this butterfly keyboard is replaced with something new, presumably this scissor switch glass fiber thing, everyone is going to freak out regardless, right? So
it's built in.
Yeah, and maybe somewhere along the line, they realize that, oh, the MacBook Air design that we've already had for a year will be able to support the new keyboard. So when it's ready to go, we'll just put it in there and just get on with our lives, right? Like, you know, if you want to fix the problem quickly, sometimes you just got to make a few people mad. And it's kind of like the fourth gen iPad, where it had to get Lightning because the iPhone had got Lightning. And, you know, the iPad 3 people from 6 months ago would probably be pretty upset about it. But sometimes that stuff just comes around and, you know, it's like the keyboard situation is not what Apple wanted, right? Like, in the ideal world, the MacBook Air would have launched earlier. It clearly got delayed by Intel, and the butterfly keyboard wouldn't need replacing. And both of those things didn't happen. And so there is, you know, a small chance in my head that maybe, yes, this is actually going to still come true. And Quo just didn't know about the current MacBook Air 2019 version, which is fair enough, because if you actually look at it, there's no supply change to it whatsoever. Right? Like, True Tone could basically just be like an internal, like, software update for all we know. And they didn't change the processor on it. They didn't change anything else about it. So if you're just looking at the supply chain perspective, you know, this is still the 2018 MacBook Air just with a price drop, right? Realistically. So if there was a new version coming in the fall, maybe it does, right? So I'm not, like, completely discounting it, but it definitely is, you know, an awkward report when a week later you know, quote unquote, new MacBook, partially refreshed MacBook Pros and a MacBook Air come out with the same keyboard design.
Yeah, I think Shijun does require hardware on the near the webcam where it has this other sensor for.
Yeah, it has like one extra color sensor, like color.
Yeah, but that's all. That's also in the supply pipeline because of all the other machines that it's already on. So it's hard to distinguish. Like, is it for this or that? All I can say is obviously Johnny Ive was Ming-Chi Kuo's source, and now he's gone and he's got no information. So. It makes sense. Design, hardware, it's all there. Busted. So we'll see what happens there. I will say, for once, on this back-to-school promotion, kudos to Apple for having new Macs out in time for the back-to-school promotion. Because last year, there was the back-to-school promotion for all the old stuff. And then after school started, there were new Macs.
Yeah, and they only revved like the high-end MacBook Pro, which is not really the student computer.
Yeah, exactly. And so this year, they did better pricing for students, and these are the ones to buy. They're not going to be outdated in a few months with something better. So that went well. And then finally, we have iPad rumors.
This is a small little thing, but obviously, if you think back to the start of the year, there were loads of like smoke and fire around a 10.2-inch iPad, right?
Yeah, which didn't materialize.
Didn't materialize. What came out in March was the 10.5-inch iPad Air. But at the time, if you remember the veritable Twitter leaker, Coin, that guy.
Coin.
C-O-I and a million I's, then an N. He said that both the 10.5 and the 10.2-inch iPads are coming, not at the same time. So, you know, the 10.2-inch iPad's still been in the offing. And this week, we had some Chinese media reports to suggest that the 10.2-inch iPad is going into production later in July. So, not very long for that. Plus... the Eurasian Commission regulatory database, where loads of stuff gets scooped early because Apple has to like register it because it contains encryption, quote unquote, and it, you know, they leak everything nowadays, has registered 5 new iPad models. Probably somewhere in there is this 10.2-inch iPad. So, and the Eurasian database says that these models are running iPad OS 13, which suggests a full release, September time. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So... earlier in the show, we said that Apple cleaned up the MacBook lineup at the cost of killing the MacBook. The iPad lineup, I think we're all pretty happy with the iPad Mini, was it 5 now? And then the iPad Air 2, and then the 2 iPad Pros. Where does the 10.2-inch iPad fall in that lineup? And are they about to botch the good lineup for the iPad now?
Most sensibly, it should just replace the 9.7-inch iPad.
So you've got, okay, so the 9.7-inch is the really budget one.
Yeah, that's the 329 one.
Yeah, which is less spec'd out than the iPad Mini 5.
Correct, because they haven't changed that one this year, right? The 329 iPad is unchanged.
Yeah, so you'd be giving the budget people a better machine.
I wouldn't expect it to look like the iPad Pro design, obviously, that hardware design. No. I think it would just be a slightly bigger screen with slightly smaller side bezels, kind of like the iPad Air.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
or, you know, which is the first 10.5-inch iPad, you mean, which is now called Air, but the first one was a Pro, right?
Yes, but obviously the current Air has those kind of like slimmer side bezels, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think this entry level iPad's going to be. The 9.7-inch design's gone; it's going to 10.2. It helps support iOS 13 stuff. Oh, it's got slightly bigger space, you know, to do your work, and. Yeah. You're not getting like a massive, you know, hardware revision. You're just getting a slightly bigger screen with slightly smaller side bezels. Okay. And you still have Touch ID and all of that baloney.
Which would be, I think, the first time that Apple dedicates a whole new design, or at least screen size, to a lower end option. Because so far it's been that the iPad Mini hardware is the same since like version 2.
Yeah.
And then the iPad Air 2 is the old iPad Pro design.
Yeah, I can't see them introducing another iPad in between 9.7 and 10.5, right? Like,
okay, makes a little bit of
sense. It just seems like it's going to be the 9.7 successor.
Yeah. And then this 16-inch MacBook Pro seems like it's coming this year, this fall even.
Oh, yeah, the same Chinese report that said that the iPad was going into production in July said that the 16-inch was going into production in, like, September time. So,
yeah.
Make that what you will.
Which potentially ruins the whole Air means wedge shape, Pro means touch bar square. It could now mean that Pro means good keyboard too if it's a certain size. And so there's more explanation required for the what today makes more sense for the MacBook lineup.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see on that one for sure.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, I hope Ming-Chi Kuo gets a hold of Johnny Ive at, what is it called? Love From?
Stupid Love name. From. He must have also thought up the Find My name. That must have been one of his last projects before he left, because they're both stupid names.
All right. That is the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZA Mayo.
And also follow 9to5Mac on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. And if you have any feedback for the show, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.